So far, everybody's okay. One's hunkered down in a restaurant near where some of this is happening.
As the city of Paris reels from terrorist attacks today, an Anchorage woman keeps in touch with family in the city. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, November 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the city of Bethel adds sexual orientation to their anti-discrimination ordinance.
It's a needed protection. It's something that is very important, both symbolically and for the well-being of our employees.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
The world watched in horror today as multiple attacks struck Paris. Paris officials say the death toll could exceed 120. For one Anchorage woman, the tragedy hits close to home. Caroline Miller is a dual U.S. and French citizen. She just returned from Paris on Monday evening after visiting relatives. From her home in East Anchorage, she's keeping in touch with her cousins on Facebook.
So far, everybody's okay. One's hunkered down in a restaurant near where some of this is happening. One is out in the suburbs, but she has a lot of friends who are actually being held in the Bataclan right now in the nightclub there.
Miller lived in Paris in the 80s and 90s, and she's been to the nightclub where NPR reports hostages are being held. She spoke to APRN this afternoon while the siege was still underway. Later, Miller said her cousin was posting about friends who were at the hospital with gunshot wounds and others not accounted for. Miller was in contact with another cousin while he was holed up in a restaurant in Laval, where the 10th arrondissement, where at least 11 people were killed.
And I said, go home. And he said, no, I feel safer here right now. I think they kind of just don't even want to get out because who knows what could happen next.
Miller says she and her husband are now reviewing their time in Paris, thinking about the spots where they were vulnerable. Mostly, she says, they just feel awful, as heartbroken as everyone else, whether they've been to Paris or not. A 22-year-old Ketchikan man remains missing on Deer Mountain as the search stretched into a third day today. Ketchikan Volunteer Rescue Squad crews headed back up the mountain this morning to continue searching an area that they believe Justin Nathan was headed toward. On Wednesday evening, search crews found tracks in the snow pointing them in that direction. Jerry Kiefer of KVRS says low ceilings today meant crews assigned to search upper elevations had to hike up rather than fly. That delayed the start of that portion of the search. Crews assigned to the lower elevation portions were able to start searching by 8:30 a.m. Kiefer says KVRS is switching out search teams where possible to reduce fatigue among the volunteers.
It's very difficult ground to be searching, and you know, some of the volunteers are now on the third day, so we're certainly feeling the effects of that.
Kiefer says the search remains a rescue operation rather than a recovery, although he says conditions have not been ideal.
Hypothermia at some point is going to be a factor because we haven't had any dry weather. It's been fairly poor conditions. When they actually left on the initial hike, it was poor conditions then. So he's been outside now for well over 3 days.
Nathan hiked up to the top of the mountain with a friend on Wednesday. They made it to the summit and then started back down. Kiefer says at about the second overlook, Nathan wasn't able to continue. So his friend handed over extra clothing and left to get help with the understanding that Nathan would stay at the overlook. However, crews did not find him there. Today's search teams were called back at around 4 p.m. when it became dark. Kiefer says the search will resume tomorrow morning. Bethel City Council has passed laws prohibiting discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity for city employees and contracted workers. The ordinances passed quickly and unanimously on Tuesday without resistance during council discussion and public comment. Councilmember Chuck Herman introduced the measures.
It's a needed protection. It's something that is very important, both symbolically and for the well-being of our employees.
The ordinances add sexual orientation and gender identity in the city's protected class alongside others like national origin, age, and religion. These protections do not extend to the private sector. There are two different Juneau events this weekend to raise awareness about heroin addiction. The capital city has logged 7 heroin-related deaths this year, and the community is banding together to talk about what's happening to their neighbors and family. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
Michelle Morgan said she wasn't aware of an opioid problem in Juneau. The realization happened gradually. When it came time for her teenage son to have his wisdom teeth cut out, she asked if he would tell his friends.
And he said, no, Mom, don't tell anyone. I have my wisdom teeth out. Don't tell anyone. And I was like, Dylan, why? It doesn't make any sense. He said, Mom, because they'll come to our house and they know I have oxycodones.
That was about 9 years ago. Oxycodone, like heroin, is an opioid. It elicits the same effect on the brain. If you look at the recent drug seizures in Juneau, heroin is gradually increasing. Morgan, the director of the Juneau Softball Association, said she noticed a shift in 2014. That's when one of the young players died of an overdose.
And no one talked about it except through the grapevine. And we have a benefit tournament we do, and we do plaques for our players who have passed. So we did a plaque for that kid. And then 6 months later, we lost another kid to the same, to heroin.
Then another, Brenner Hafner, in his mid-20s.
Like one of my children.
He used to play softball on her team.
And I came home and I was mad and I was scared. And so I went on my computer and I ordered some stickers and some magnets, anything I could get to make me feel that I was getting the word out.
The stickers said, heroin will kill you and your friends. Please don't start. That snowballed into the grassroots initiative, Stop Heroin, Start Talking. The Juneau police noticed a trend last year in heroin deaths, and they're tracking it now. During the next few months, they'll be releasing videos of users speaking out about their struggles with addiction.
Did you ever go into withdrawals?
Yes.
What did that feel like?
Just wanting to die.
The people appear in silhouette, their voices altered.
So hot and so cold. And just
Morgan says the hope with her initiative is education, but also to remove the stigma attached to losing a loved one. Then there's policy change, like Senate Bill 23. It allows a medication called naloxone to be given out at train agencies or sold over the counter at pharmacies.
And naloxone, under the brand name Narcan, stops immediately the heroin overdose or the opiate overdose. Is it a cure for addiction? No, but it could save lives.
The bill, sponsored by Senator Johnny Ellis, has already passed the Senate. It now needs to pass the House. And as the legislative session gets underway, Morgan says she'll be focusing her energy promoting it. Overall, she says she wants to inform the community that having addiction isn't a character flaw. It's a health crisis, and one that can be addressed.
We're coming out. We're not going to, you know, hide our family members or be ashamed. We're gonna kick heroin's butt, and we're gonna do that as a group.
Before she leaves, she hands me a Stop Heroin, Start Talking bracelet. Morgan says she's handed them out to everyone she meets. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, big wins for University of Alaska cross-country teams.
We've kind of checked back a little bit on records, and we don't know if that's ever happened, or at least hasn't happened in a long time.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
As Chief Justice Dana Fabe prepares to retire next May, there are 8 candidates vying to fill the empty position on Alaska's Supreme Court. The applicants were announced today, and they are Ruth Botstein, Susan Carney, Kevin Clarkson, Andrew Guidi, Jonna Lindemuth, Philip Hallenberg, Paul Rotman, and David Volokh. Justices are required to meet certain residency standards, and between them, they have 223 years of residency in Alaska and nearly 200 years of experience practicing law. After candidates are reviewed by the state's judicial council, 2 names are passed to the governor, who has 45 days to make a decision about who will serve on the bench. The position of Chief Justice is decided among the 5 members of the court. For 8 consecutive seasons, both the University of Alaska Anchorage's men's and women's cross-country running teams qualified for the NCAA Division II National Championships. This year, they even picked up 2 titles along the way at last weekend's West Region Championships in Monmouth, Oregon. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
UAA took the top 2 spots in both the men's and women's races. According to head cross-country coach Michael Fries, that accomplishment is very rare.
We've kind of checked back a little bit on records, and we don't know if that's ever happened, or at least hasn't happened in a long time. Now, one school has had the 1st and 2nd finishers in each of the races.
Taking the top spot in the women's race was UAA junior Joyce Chilemo, who is coming back after a redshirt season where she took a season-long hiatus from collegiate competition. She says the year away from racing allowed her to come back this season stronger, both mentally and physically.
I'm now like mentally prepared, and I'm strong enough that I can handle the pain than when I was like 2 years ago. I think it comes with experience, and when I was sitting back and I wasn't competing, I was looking back at myself, like, what do I need to improve? What are my competitors doing that I don't do?
Chelimo's 20-minute, 42-second time on the 6-kilometer course put her atop the leaderboard, followed about 17 seconds later by fellow UAA runner Caroline Kurgat. Coach Fries, who's in the midst of his 26th season at the helm of the cross-country team, says the meet was a solid showing.
The main goal is to have both teams qualify for the national championship and, you know, to try to then, you know, carry some momentum into a national meet.
That goal was achieved. The men's team qualified for nationals with the help of Henry Chisetto's 2nd straight first-place finish at the West Region meet. He says he's happy he won the regional title again, but now he's looking to improve his performance at the national meet.
If I take, I look back to what I did last year, is I was almost there, meaning I have today to sit there and make sure I will stay with the fast group.
Chisetto ran the 10-kilometer West Region course in 29 minutes and 29 seconds, followed by Dominic Knotts, also of UAA, less than 3 seconds later. With 32 teams on the docket for the national championships, Coach Fries says you can never tell how things will play out.
What every team hopes is that they just have their best race. You know, they can run up, you know, not up to their potential, not maybe, you know, something above what they've ever done before, but at least just run what they've been able to run. And I think if we can do that, then we're going to be pretty satisfied with our outcome.
The NCAA Division II Men's and Women's Cross Country Championships will be held November 21st in Joplin, Missouri, at the Tom Rutledge Cross Country Course hosted by Missouri Southern State University. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
The Bethel City Council has declared a local government disaster following the Kilbuck fire that incinerated the Yupik Immersion School and damaged the Kuskokwim Learning Academy school and dorms. The declaration asked the governor to declare an emergency and allocate recovery funds to the city to help rebuild the school and repair city equipment, among other requests, including help with property reclamation from asbestos. The school district informed the city and fire department 2 days after the incident that the demolished school contained asbestos. The school district has to hire certified crews to clean up and dispose of the rubble, and emergency personnel involved in containing the fire were possibly exposed to hazardous materials. City Manager Ann Capella said the accident opens an opportunity to update the municipal code and require buildings to post notices of dangerous substances.
It certainly opened our eyes on having the ability to know what's in the building when you're fighting the fire.
Capella said the site might also contain PCBs and lead. A 37-year-old Alaska man has been charged with kidnapping and raping a woman over a five-week span at a remote cabin more than 100 miles west of Fairbanks. A preliminary hearing was scheduled November 20th for Daniel Selovich, who was arrested Sunday when he and the woman were brought to Fairbanks. The woman was hospitalized. Troopers say he held her against her will at a cabin located about 16 miles south of Manly Hot Springs. That's a tiny village at the end of the Elliott Highway, the only road link to Fairbanks. When the State Department of Transportation took over the Kinnickarm Crossing Project from previous managers within the Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority, or KABATA, in July of last year, planners took a fresh look at traffic projections needed to ensure adequate tolls could be collected to pay project costs. But as KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, critics of the new plan say it's the same old numbers game.
A socioeconomic study released by the State Department of Transportation shows a scaled-down approach to fiscal plans to pay for the proposed bridge linking Anchorage and the Mat-Su Borough. DOT has applied for a federal loan to foot the bill for the bulk of construction costs, according to Project Director Judy Doherty. She says the new look incorporates recent information.
Since DOT and the state is bringing financing to this project, they are taking a much more conservative look at the population projection.
Doherty says that the new financing outlook would depend on a minimum of 18,000 vehicles a day paying a toll to cross the bridge. The traffic projections are based on expectations of population growth in the borough. Doherty says under the current plan, toll revenues from the bridge are to be tapped to pay for the state's share of the construction costs of the project. Doherty points out that the old plan relied on tolls to pay for all bridge construction costs.
Under the new plan, which is a public finance plan, the tolls will only be responsible for paying for operations and maintenance and for the TIFIA loan, which is approximately one-third of the construction cost.
A TIFIA loan is federal transportation money. The bridge project has applied for and been denied TIFIA funds half a dozen times. But the traffic projections for potential users of the proposed Kinnickarm Bridge are not realistic, according to an opponent of the project, independent financial analyst Jamie Kenworthy. He says consultants for the bridge project have inflated traffic estimates.
The DOT has now spent $1 million on new consultants to come up with the same numbers criticized by the LBNA audit. Their population projections for Mat-Su in 2040 project 60% more growth than the state demographer and that AMATS, the Anchorage Transportation Unit, is using for their 2040 plan.
Kenworthy, a longtime critic of the bridge, brought his analysis to a meeting of the KABATA board in Anchorage on Thursday. DOT consultants' information shows a doubling of population by 2040 in most Mat-Su communities based on 2012 population figures.
And KABATA DOT has now put five times more people and twice as many jobs at Point McKenzie in 2040 than the borough's own consultant projected for 2035.
Doherty says DOT's population projections are centered on growth at Point McKenzie. She says TIFIA experts will decide on the validity of the toll estimates.
Our studies will have to be investment grade. We'll have to get two rating opinions, and they will evaluate our project and our projections.
Kenworthy counters that a fiscally strapped state needs to proceed with caution.
We still have a AAA rating for now, and the feds are not going to care about these nonsensical numbers. The state has to care, because when the toll shortfall comes, this becomes either debt service at the front end of the budget that it takes away from other transportation projects and teachers and public safety, or the state defaults.
The KABATA board did not have a quorum at the meeting and took no action on Thursday. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on Condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Alaska Pacific University is accepting applications for all undergraduate programs for the spring 2016 semester. More at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechmute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Monica Goki. This week on AK, history found. Workers remodeling one of Petersburg's oldest buildings have uncovered Norwegian artifacts dating back a century. The items are linked to some of the town's earliest Norwegian settlers. And as KFSK's Angela Denning reports, one woman in town is helping to make sure these treasures are preserved for future generations.
Jill Williams is in her early 60s, but she's drawn to objects before her time. When she walks me through Petersburg's Sons of Norway Hall, she feels right at home. The large barn-like building was built on the waterfront in 1912. The original parts and pieces are Williams's favorite.
And here's, you know, the old doorknob, the old glass doorknob. And they just don't make things like they used to. I mean, you know, they're real sturdy.
On the outside, the hall is white with a red roof and trim and traditional flowery rose mauling designs on the window frames. It remains Petersburg's largest gathering place. Countless conferences, weddings, even funerals have been held here. Williams has been a member of Petersburg's Sons of Norway Lodge for over 40 years. Her grandparents came from Norway, so when she found out that the carpenters working on the hall had found artifacts in the walls and floor, she was pretty excited.
Oh, I'll show you where the board was found. So the beer bottles were found, Jimmy said, like right, you know, down in here.
Workers found a rough-cut board with Norwegian writing on it, an old inkwell, an old leather-bound notepad, and a leather pouch for holding a few knives, as well as empty beer bottles. The artifacts are now on display in a glass case near the hall's entrance. Williams admires the antique bottles.
And look how beautiful they are. And the paper's really heavy. And I lightly dusted it. I didn't want to take all the grime off.
The beer bottles are made of thick glass and nearly as tall as modern-day wine bottles.
What was really cool is one has a Rainier label and the other one has Olympia label. And 1906 labels. Yeah, it says 1906 on them. Uh-huh. But anyway, they're in our display case.
So they were in the walls of the hall?
The beer bottles were found, like, you know, inside the wall, just like they had drank their beer and then dropped it down in the walls and closed up the wall.
Lucky they did that for everyone now.
Well, and I'm thinking there's probably more treasures in the walls that, you know, haven't been found. And I told the carpenters, I said, you know, before you close up these walls, you guys need to probably drop a few things in there for the next 100 years.
Williams's interest in preserving Petersburg's history goes beyond the walls of the hall. Upstairs, there are several rooms with various kinds of furniture. Most of it has been replaced over the decades. In a nearby dark storage room, Williams leans under a slanted ceiling, where she finds another original, a beat-up old chair that is losing its stuffing. She runs her hand over its back.
Poor old chair. But that must have been one of those chairs those ladies sat in and relaxed.
It's not just about the objects. It's about the people who used them. Like the person who wrote in Norwegian on the board that was found in the wall back in 1912? His name was Hans Vik.
I thought, who's Hans Vik?
Through research, Williams found out that Vik had come to Petersburg in 1908 and quickly became an involved community member. He was the town marshal, the fire chief, the health officer, and the superintendent of public works. So what did he write on the board?
Well, everybody will have to interpret this as they see fit. So this is what old Hans wrote in Norwegian, translated into English. As you mess around in a couple of bunks, you'll get the answer, says the old Hans.
The exact meaning of Hans Vik's message might never be known, but that's okay with Williams. She's fine with just appreciating the new artifacts as a link to the town's Norwegian history. For AK, I'm Angela Denning.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Becky Itakyak, who is Inupiaq, Siberian Yupik, and Tlingit. She makes drums for a living now, but it wasn't an easy skill to learn.
I started making drums in 76. This was prior to the permanent fund, and each drum, the only drums I ever found were either clan property, I grew up in Southeast. The other drums that were available were at gift shops, and they were like outrageous. They were $800-$900, and that was like, wow. So I decided that the only way I was gonna get my hands on a drum was to learn how to make drums. And so I basically bugged the elders. I went to the Sitka Cultural Center, which is run by the National Park Service in Sitka. There was a gentleman there that saw that I was really trying hard, and I was driving the elders nuts trying to figure out how to make drums, how to, you know, I was like chasing hunters, you know, where did you put the hide? I was wandering around the woods, you know, looking for deer skin, you know. That didn't dawn on me to go to the dump. One artist took me, Steve Brown. He's now, I think he's still a curator in UW, but he's well known in the Southeast cultural arts scene down in Southeast. And he taught me this technique of stitching the drums on, and that's the way I've made them since 76.
Becky Itakyak lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. If you want to tell your story, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK. We had help this week from Angela Denning, Ann Hillman, Annie Fite, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Monica Gokey. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Layla Carey in Ketchikan, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, and Ellen Lockyer, Josh Edge, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Gokey is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
the University of Alaska Southeast, with schools of arts and sciences, management, education, and career education in Juneau, Ketchikan, and Sitka. UAS, a learning community on campus and online. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
Celebrate National Philanthropy Day in Alaska and honor outstanding small businesses like Two Friends Gallery for their work to make Alaska a better place to live and raise Alaskan families. Join the celebration on Friday, November 20th at the Denina Center. Visit afpalaska.net. This message sponsored by Alaska Public Media and AFP Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.